Welcome, everyone, to the Raucous Caucus, and this is Mark Levine with Terry DeKester and Garland Nixon. Terry, you want to talk about energy today?
Well, just only because, you know, the end of the world is coming a little bit sooner than I assumed. And I just thought maybe we should discuss it so we can, you know, maybe do something about it. There's a fascinating article that I just recently read by Robert Bryce, and I know I have no respect for Robert Bryce. Well, I won't say I have no respect. He's knowledgeable, I will say that. He is very much connected to the petroleum industry, et cetera. And he's very conservative, but he's also got some very interesting information that cannot be ignored. And the basic point
is... We can give it a shot. We can try to ignore it.
Well, that's what we're basically doing, you know. And that's the basic problem. But this is astounding, this little bit of information I've got for you on what's happening with the energy increases in the world. And we know that we're at, over 400 parts per million of CO2 equivalency in the atmosphere, and 350 parts per million, you know, is the danger point that we were trying to stay below, which we haven't achieved, so now we need to get back down to it if we can. But at any rate, over the past four decades, oil use has grown by, 34 million barrels per day.
People don't know what that means, though.
Well,
34 million, that's a number. It's a big number. What does it mean?
It's increased daily from 34 by 34 million barrels per day. If you were
using one screwed, barrel, Mark. That's what it means. We're totally screwed.
Okay. No, I think that's you use a large number and people don't know what it means, and I am getting feedback.
I mean, you're not using one barrel of oil in your car every single day. You're simply not using that much of crude oil after it's been refined and everything else. So you just imagine if you did use one barrel of crude oil in your car every day, since you've been in the last four decades, since that time, there has increased 34 million barrels every single day, times 365, times four decades.
And that's in the United States?
That's in the world.
That's in the world.
That's in the world. Coal use, and that's, in other words, what's really happened is the percent of crude oil being used, in other words, in fuel, et cetera, is increased in the last four decades by 61%. Pretty astounding.
There you go. That's the number I needed to hear. Percentage, okay. I can wrap my mind around. Okay. I can't wrap my mind around 34 million barrels. That just
right. That's... Wrap your mind.
All right, got to wrap my mind. So increase has gone up 61% in what, 10 years?
In 40 years.
In 40 years.
4 decades.
Okay.
Same time, we've gone up 140% in use of equivalent coal.
Wow, 140%.
140%.
I assume a lot of that's done in China. I know that, for example, in Beijing and in other, frankly, in almost every Chinese city, the soot is so thick that people have to wear masks out in the street. I mean, it puts L.A. smog to shame in terms of their contribution to global warming, mostly with coal.
People have to stay in – there are danger days, weeks – they're having weeks at a time where people are told to stay indoors. I've seen – you can go online and look at some videos, and I saw one – basically, there was one comparison. It was a scientific comparison of the air where they showed that it was like the same as if – forest fire, and you were standing next to the forest fire.
Yeah, and that's because
and
of
that
the,
was in the movie.
That's the Chinese use of coal, and of course, all the global warming worldwide has caused the Arctic ice cap to basically cease to exist. I mean, this is amazing. I mean, you know, for the last, 100,000 years or so, there has been an ice cap on the top of the globe. When people looked, they were exploring America and looked for the Northwest Passage, they couldn't find their way around the northern part of our continent because they had too much ice. I guess they could find it now.
Yeah, they do. And just so you know, in terms of natural gas, that has increased in oil equivalent per day of 184%. And just to correct, I mean, yes, China and India, are using coal like crazy and polluting like crazy, but we are still the leaders in pollution.
I think we're the leaders per capita, but not the leaders in actual numbers, because they each have more than a billion people. in India and China. I think they pollute more total, but we definitely pollute most per capita, per person.
Yes, we do. Without, I mean, we're still the biggest energy per capita consumer of anybody in the world. But the numbers are just astounding of how much we keep on increasing carbon dioxide producing fuels and keep on using them. And of course, now with the coal shale, I mean, with the shale natural gas, et cetera, that's being produced, and the coal shale that's being dug up, we're just increasing at the point where you now know the United States is now an exporter of coal and oil.
Wow. And the other thing I was reading in the Washington Post magazine just this week is that there are islands that used to exist in the Chesapeake Bay in Maryland with houses and everything that don't exist anymore because of the water level rising.
That's one of our hopes, because most people don't realize, you know, that Washington, D.C. is pretty close to sea level, and so we're hoping as water rises that, you know, we're going to wash at least the Republicans who don't understand.
Hey now, you know, don't attack the city. It's the rest of America that puts those politicians in this city. Uh-oh. Don't blame the city for the politicians now, Terry. Come on. I'm in Washington. The water's not too far from here.
Yes, I know. You're doomed. I hate to tell you that.
Anacostia River is like, I can throw a stone and hit it from here. Don't wish ill on our city here. Blame the politicians, not the city. Anyway, go ahead.
Okay, and just to give you that, we're now exporting 3.9 million barrels of refined products every day. Way back in 1973, just to give you a little interesting perspective, we exported 211,000 barrels of refined products per day. Now we're exporting 3.9 million barrels of refined products. Most of that, by the way, is diesel fuel.
Okay, so you've given us a lot of numbers, and you've given us a lot of scary things, all of which are true, I'm sure. But what's the answer, Terry? We all looking for an answer.
Run. Dig a hole. Hide your head in the sand.
I mean, Mars, it might be a little cold, and Venus might be a little hot. So this is the only planet we've got. I mean, the moon doesn't have a lot of water.
Let me throw this in there, Mark, because that's a very good question. What is the answer? Because human beings cannot fathom the reality that if we continue what we're doing, and it may be too late, that either all or most human beings will cease to exist within the next 200-300 years. Human beings can't wrap their mind around that. So they have to say what's the answer, because they assume that there is an answer, because it couldn't possibly be that we're going to be that, when the fact of the matter is there have been a number of die-offs where 90% of the organisms on this earth have perished. It wouldn't be the first time.
No.
The human body can't tolerate a variance in temperature, a variance in radiation, a variance in lots of tiny little parts of our habitat. The slightest variance, and we all die. The reality is, based on what we're doing, it's absurd to say that we're not going to, as a species, get either completely or mostly wiped out. So what are you guys
thinking? You know, I'm not that gloomy and doomy. I realize that sometimes we have to talk about the worst in order to get people to spur to action, and I realize that nobody's doing anything, and I realize that talk might be necessary, but I do think there are answers. I think there are windmills. I think there's geothermal energy. I think solar energy has come a long way. There are clean, natural ways to produce energy, and we need to put more money and effort in them, but I'm not willing to concede the loss of the planet. Not quite yet.
The planet's going to be fine.
Okay, humanity. Fine, humanity.
The planet is going to be just 100,000 years or so. Everything goes back. You'll never know there was a problem.
And according to the latest science, even though we may wipe ourselves out, Ted Cruz is going to survive.
That's
really scary. But, you know, that's the big question.
Yeah, because he's a very basic life form. You know, he's kind of like, you know, like a, you know,
cockroach.
You know, those basic life forms like that, you know, they can survive lots of things.
Yeah, something between a cockroach and Dracula. I'm not sure where he lies exactly. But you asked the big question, and that is, what can we do about it? And it's really, really tough, because what we're talking about here is, as Garland mentioned in the very beginning, we're talking about denial. It is such a huge concept. It is such a huge concept to embrace that people, and I'm not even condemning anybody by this, but people naturally don't want to face it. don't want to face what Garland was just talking about, don't want to. We want to think that everything's going to adapt, and we're going to adapt with it, and it's all going to be okay. And how to change that psychology or that misconception and how to get past that denial is the question I'm raising today, and I don't have an answer. I'm sorry, guys. I wasn't calling up with an answer today. You know, I usually have all the answers, but this time I don't have it.
No, but my point is there are – it's not like we do not know the existence of clean technologies that don't put carbon in the air and do create energy. I mean, I just named three of them, and they are growing. Admittedly, they need some help, but Europe, for example, is far along the way. I mean, you go to Europe, and there's solar panels on virtually every home. So it's not that this is impossible. It takes political will and so forth. But before the apocalypse comes, there are things we can do.
And the general pattern, though, is for the human race, we don't react really until something disastrous happens. I mean, until we get about five more Katrinas.
Okay, go ahead, Garland.
And I'll tell you what this reminds me of, Mark. Reminds me of a smoker. It reminds me of a person who smokes cigarettes every day, drink every day, and everybody tells them, look, you're going to get cancer, you're going to have a stroke, you're going to do whatever, and they just continue to do it. Because in their mind, they think that it's almost like they think, well, I'll have some indicator that this is going to happen, and once I get this indicator, I can stop just before I die. But that's not what happens, Mark. They go to the doctor one day, and the doctor says, you got 4 months. I'm sorry. There's nothing we can do. You've got lung cancer. See, that's what we're doing. We're like smokers. We're smoking, and we're polluting our lungs, and we're thinking for some reason that because we know what to do, all we have to do is wait until things get horrible, and then we're told, well, you're not going to make it, and that somehow we can start building windmills. That's not the way it works, Mark.
I think that's actually a really good metaphor. I think smoking is a perfect metaphor because there are people who quit smoking. They say, in fact, if you quit smoking, that after about 20 years, your lungs do rebuild themselves and you're almost as healthy as if you've never smoked. But it takes 20 years. And most people, as you say, Garland, don't stop until it's too late. So I think that's a perfect metaphor.
And that's why I've been using the word denial. I mean, because that's really what we're in. We're in denial. But to answer your question, I think the only thing that can be done is we really, 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 really have to keep the pressure on the federal government, Republicans included, good luck, to subsidize development. Every time we try to subsidize, development of any kind of alternative energy, the oil industry and everybody else screams, it's just, we're government giveaway and it's not working and so on and so forth. Forgetting the fact that every major development in energy, and for that matter, most industry, has always been subsidized by the government to start it.
That's sure. Of course, everything from the railroads to the interstate highway system to canals to anything involving transportation.
And even a fascinating little thing that I just found out, which is just a little side note here, but it shows the power of what the government does, that how it affects things and can affect it either positive or negative, is, believe it or not, gasoline that was being used. And it wasn't necessarily the ideal fuel in any way, shape, or form. The other fuel that was being used frequently was alcohol. Well, you may remember about the same time we're going crazy but developing automobiles all over the place that we decided to have prohibition.
Well, that would have been a great use for the alcohol, right?
No, because what we did is to make sure prohibition worked, or thought we would make it work, is we increased the taxes on alcohol to exponential levels.
Including for cars?
Alcohol, period.
Huh, I didn't know that.
Across the board. And so this is for 14 years that we had, prohibition, I think that's the right number.
That's right.
Yeah, 14 years, and during that time, it's just too expensive to use alcohol. Gasoline is relatively cheap, so all of the automobile development in those 14 years goes to making gasoline/oil the primary fuels. It's not just an example of what government subsidies or government choices can make on any progressive or destructive, for that matter, pattern.
I read somewhere, and I don't know whether this is something that's practical or just something in a scientist's mind's eye, and I'm no engineer. Maybe y'all can help me out here. But I remember reading somewhere that both hydrogen and oxygen can be used to propel automobiles, and that obviously when you combine hydrogen and oxygen, not only do you get energy, but your waste product is H2O. It's water. It's the cleanest thing we got. So... I read, now I don't know if this is theoretical or someone's actually done this. Maybe I need to talk to Elon Musk.
Yeah.
It was done.
There's some issues with that because it takes energy to extract the hydrogen or whatever. So you still have to utilize some energy to make it, put it in a usable form.
Okay.
But here's the other thing. You know, we can't even, you know, we have governments that can't even perform the most basic of functions right now. And to say that we're going to, you know, achieve some grand change, you know, that we have to do. Let me put it like this. I don't think we can do it because we're using the wrong paradigm. We need to do it because we're all going to die if we don't. But what we think...
Well, not we. I mean, let's face it. Wait, not we. It's going to be our great-great-great-grandchildren, and I think that may be part of the problem.
Because we don't even know how long it could be. It could be 10 years, it could be 20 years from now, it could be 100 years from now. But we do know that if we continue to do what we're doing, we're going to make the planet uninhabitable. There's little question about that for human beings. But here's what I'm saying. We go at it with the paradigm that the best thing for everybody is if businesses make lots of money. So we say we need to do it because it's going to create jobs. We need to do it because businesses will make more money. And we need to do it because there'll be more industry. When the fact of the matter, if we make those arguments, we are arguing into the business paradigm, which the business says it's going to cost us money. We're making their argument stronger. I think we need to use the argument to the business community, to everybody. You idiots. If we don't do it, we're doomed.
Let me ask you both this.
That's the only argument.
Let me just ask you both this before we move on to another topic, and that is, what do we do about the international issue, okay? The United States burns more than anyone else per capita, but in rough numbers, the billion people plus of China and the billion people plus of India burn even more. We talked about the Chinese cities that are like living with a fire next door. How do we... Let's say we do the right thing, which I realize is no easy task. How do we help the rest of the world do the same? Because after all, we're all on the same planet. And if we alone Europe alone has solved the issue largely already. And, you know, it ain't making the planet any cleaner because of us and China and India.
The point is, if the most powerful nation in the world, and we are the most powerful nation in the world, unfortunately, and I mean that, economically and militarily, et cetera. If we don't change our policies, nobody is going to change their policies to any level. If we don't set the example, why should they? And yes, you can have all the altruistic reasons, and some of the nations are in fact changing, and maybe America would just simply become less important. Well, it is becoming less important, and it'll become more and more less important over the years. But we are the player that has to say, let's change the game. Because if we don't change the game, nobody can change the game.
All right, let's take a quick break, and then I know.
Okay.
And then, Gon, I want you to tell us what happened at Barney's in New York. And then, in the last segment, I want to talk about the healthcare website, healthcare.gov, and how Republicans are using it as an excuse to attack all of government. That's coming up on the Raucous Caucus right after this break. If you want to call in, it's 202-889-9797. We'll be right back right after this. Welcome back to the Raucous Caucus. I am Mark Levine with Garland Nixon and Terry D. Kester. And our next topic, Garland, I understand that Barney's in New York has an image problem. Tell us about that.
Well, basically, for those of you who haven't turned on the news lately, what Barney's did was they had a young 18-year-old black kid comes in. He's a cop student, I think, at New York University of Technology, something like that. At any rate, he comes in to buy a belt. He buys a $350 belt. He has a credit card with his name on it. He has an ID with his name and picture on it. He buys it. He walks inside. Apparently, Barney has called the cops. So now it moves from Barney's to the cops, and they tell him, you know, basically they've got they ask him, how can you afford that belt? He shows the receipt. He shows him his credit card. He shows shows them his identification, and they did what any reasonable person would do. They locked him up. And took him in and interrogated him. And of course, what a shock. They found out that, in fact, it was. So now he's filing a lawsuit against Barney's and against the New York City Police Department, and the question marks go all over.
Well, Garland, but
what
to be
does that say about our society, et cetera?
To be clear, that wasn't the only incident that happened. I think it was just this week that the woman also got the expensive purse from Barney's.
Yeah, a $2,700 purse or something. The fact of the matter is, there's a lot of people in need.
There are a lot of black people who have some money. There are a lot of black people with money. She bought a $2,000-some-odd purse, which, again, I don't recommend, but, hey, it's America. She has a right to buy any purse she wants. She goes, she buys the purse. They ask her for ID. She shows ID. Apparently, she had a temporary credit card, which people have until you get the permanent one, whatever. And they questioned her and didn't let her go until she proved that, that I guess who she was, who she said she was. But she kind of proved it earlier in the store. And the question is Barney's treating their black customers different from their white customers? And the answer seems to be yes, although the CEO of Barney's insisted that no one at Barney's did this, which made me wonder who were the gremlins who called the police, if not Barney's employees. Terry, your thoughts on all this?
Well, two things. One, I mean, it's tragic. It's common. It's much more common if you're poor and live in a poor area than it is somebody going to Barney's and buying $350 belt. You know, I mean, we keep on turning our back on racism and saying, no, it doesn't really exist anymore because now we have, this guy that could actually buy a $350 belt, so that proves it, even though he was denied. We turn our back on it. And part of it, frankly, is, and this is not a direction that you want to go at this moment, but part of it is, again, what Garland was referring to before, we never want to change the paradigm that we are currently in, which means that we're going to have $350 belts, which are absolutely absurd. Consider the energy and the cost that even goes into that.
Yeah.
This whole society of built on getting more, getting more, getting more, getting more, is the real reason that we are in the economic crisis we're in and the energy crisis that we're in. It's all connected. Our paradigm has to shift.
Okay, fair enough, but the paradigm exists. People want expensive things. Lots of white people buy expensive things, and black people should be able to buy expensive, wasteful things just as much as white people should be able to buy expensive, wasteful things.
Yes, freedom.
Well, that's part of it.
Let me throw something else out there that you guys might find really shocking and astounding. Pretty much every black person that I talk to about today has a story of their own that's almost identical.
That's my first point.
Walk into a room full of black people and say, what do you think about that? Every one of them. I have yet to run into anybody, black person, that doesn't say, well, let me tell you what happened to me one time.
Well, Garland, tell us what happened to you one time. Let me hear your story.
Well, I was a police officer. Mine was all, we're all police related. You know, I was in a car with a friend of mine who had a Porsche 944 back in the 80s, brand new Porsche 944. We pull out, a cop pulls us over, and one of the first words is, how do you afford this car? We were in sweatsuits going to a basketball game, and we were in our early 20s. We could afford it. He was playing professional football.
Yeah, there you go.
But the question was, well, how can you afford that? I mean, I could go on and on. Mine were mostly police related where, I was stopped by a police officer who, how can you afford this car? Or, they had no real reason for stopping or they thought you were a drug dealer or something like that, or the person I was riding with.
Let me ask you this, Garland, as an ex-cop yourself, is that a proper question to ask? How can you afford this?
Absolutely not. Remember something. Here's the thing about it. Remember something. A law enforcement officer needs probable cause that a crime has been committed or is about to be committed. You don't walk up to everyone who has on a $2,000 suit or a Mercedes. What are you going to do, pull over every Bentley? Oh, sir, step out of the car. How do you afford that Bentley?
Yeah, I guess so. I mean, and I guess rich people.
If somebody pulls you over for running a stop sign, Mark, wouldn't you expect them to say, sir, the reason I pulled you over is because you have a run. You just run a stop sign, or you were doing 60 in a 40-mile zone.
Right.
I'd like to see your license and registration.
Yeah, not how can you afford this car.
How can you afford that suit there, buddy? What are you up to?
I mean, my only question is, I wonder if this works for some other people. Maybe there are, I don't know, poor people stealing cars, and they ask that question and they confess. I don't see what the cop gets out of it other than their own. I don't get it.
Because keep in mind, and it's something, this is important, and I wish that we could get more people to talk about racism and sexism, et cetera, in this way. And that is because we call people, you are a racist or you're not a racist. We have to all realize something, and that is, in America, we all have certain implicit associations in our brain based on everything that we see. And any person, me, you, or Terry, could do something that would probably be racist or sexist. And so if you don't realize you're doing, so what's happening is a lot of these people don't realize, they don't see, these cops or other people don't stop to think to themselves, well, that's a black person, and I'm asking them if that's probably racist. They do it without thinking because these are associations in their brain that are below the level of consciousness.
I'm just curious, Garland, and I don't know the answer. Do you think that if there were an 18-year-old white kid dressed in sweats, dressed down, dressed not in a suit, obviously, driving a Bentley, that they might stop that kid as well?
Ain't happening.
You don't think so?
Ain't happening.
Terry, what do you think?
You know, I remember
No. I think that's unjustified. I just know, as a teenager myself, as a driver, not currently, I'm no longer a teenager in case you didn't know.
Yeah, no, but you're talking back in the 1700s when you're driving
a horse-drawn
carriage?
Okay. My first car.
Right.
So
Terry,
even as a teenager myself, I was continually getting into trouble. Not some of it I deserved, to be stopped doing. Others of it, it was just because I was a kid and I was a teenager and I was out past the usual hour of night or what, not that we had curfews, but, that I was out late or whatever. Yes, so, yeah, if I were a teenager today and if I were, dressed in sweats and a hood and everything else, and I were driving a Bentley, I have no doubt that you would be stopped and asked. Whether it did be used that exact question of how can you afford, but they might certainly ask, okay, whose car is this? How did you get it? Let's see the registration, et cetera, et cetera. Sure you would.
Let me give you some concrete evidence, Mark.
Okay.
When I was with the ACLU and they sued the Maryland State Police for racial profiling, here are some of the numbers. 20% of the drivers on 95, on I-95, were either black or Latino. 83% of the people that they stopped were black or Latino.
Wow.
So out of the 20% of the people, 83% of the people, and the number that they searched for drugs was in the upper 90s. So basically, if you were black or Latino and they pulled you over, the overwhelming likelihood was that you were going to get searched and, accused or at least suspected of being a drug dealer.
Well,
if you were white, probably wasn't going to happen.
Let me ask you a question, Garland, about the search for drugs, because I've been stopped a few times. I am known to have quite a heavy foot on the pedal. I concede they are the only laws that I regularly and knowingly break, the nation's speed limit laws. I'm admitting this on the air. I've been stopped a couple times, or more. But they've never once, and let's face it, I've been stopped a dozen times in my life. But it's true. Full confessions, What do you want? I do like to go fast. Although not an accident, just going fast. But anyway, I have never once been searched for drugs. Never once. I've got stern talking to's by police officers. Why were you going 80? But I have not once been stopped for drugs. So I'm fascinated by Garland's statistic that 93%.
I was a cop. I've been a drug suspect on many occasions. One time I had a BMW 525. I was in North Carolina driving down the road. I saw a cop going in the other direction. And I saw him do a U-turn and come behind me on a double yellow line. Basically an illegal U-turn. He's coming. I saw him look at me. He did a U-turn. And I knew when he did the U-turn that he was, oh no, there's a black guy in a new BMW. There's a criminal if I ever seen one. Does a U-turn, pulls me over. And I didn't identify myself as a police officer. But the long and short of it was, he attempted to ask me some questions to indicate which indicated that he thought I was a drug suspect. However, knowing the Constitution like I was, I handed him my ID, and I would not say a word no matter what question he asked me. I did not answer, and I didn't say anything. And after a while, he got frustrated and handed me my stuff back and walked away. But he didn't say, the reason I pulled you over was because you were, whatever, violating some traffic law. He started off with, you're from out of state, huh? Yeah. What are you doing in this town?
Which he has no right to know.
He went on and on. you know.
And you were just silent, Garland?
You were just
silent when he asked you, what are you doing in this town?
Yeah, I didn't say a word. I didn't say anything. I refused to say anything.
Wow.
He asked me several questions, and at some point he realized, you know, this guy's got a pretty good grip on the Constitution.
Yeah.
I think I better get out of here. He could be a lawyer or something.
Yeah. Wow. Wow, that's hard to do, because you know he's got a badge and a gun, and it's his neighborhood, and to just say nothing. I mean, of course, I'm never in that good a situation, because usually I have been speeding, so I got to be nice.
But that's one, Mark. If I kept going into the stories, we'd be here. I mean, you don't have enough time on your show.
Yeah.
For me to tell you how many times I've been a drug suspect with absolutely no evidence. I'm a cop. No evidence. You pull someone over for the most minor. You pull someone over because, listen to this, they've got a little tree air freshener hanging from their mirror, and it's blocking. It's that you pull them over because it's blocking their view. So obviously, any person with a little, no, that is selective enforcement.
Well, Gar, let me ask you this.
Constitutionally, what?
You've seen it from both sides. Most of us have only seen it as, you know, we're the driver getting stopped. You've been a police officer. You've been with other police officers. It wasn't traffic violations, given what you did, resource, but.
Well, but we did. We had traffic both.
Okay. So have you ever been with
State Police?
Well, let me ask you this then. From the other side of the blue line, have you ever been with a police officer who wanted to make or did make a stop that you felt was racially motivated?
Or more importantly,
no,
did you ever make
a stop
based on your intuition?
No.
There's the big question.
No, because that's the Constitution. I had never found anything about the intuition in the Constitution. And I trained people at our academy, and I taught them very clearly. This is about the Constitution. And if you go outside of that and you get sued, we're going to fire you
while
they're suing you, so that we relieve the agency of liability. So if you go outside the Constitution and stop people on intuition or whatever, and this person sues you, we're going to charge you, we're going to fire you, and we're going to put forth the documents that show we trained you that you have to go by the Constitution. So you can do it if you want to, but you're going to get hanged by us and hanged by whoever sues you.
We've discussed this at length before, guys, and you know I understand and I agree with 90% of what Garland's saying, except for one fact. And that is, it's impossible to get rid of this entirely. Yes, we have to have the legal protection and everything else. Yes, we should be outraged when it's misused. But as you said at the very beginning, Garland, every one of us has, you know, basic emotional patterns, you know, that are built into us over a lifetime, and we use intuition. And the other side of that coin is we expect and demand, particularly today when crime has increased 15% in the last year, violent crime has increased 15%, we want our police to prevent crime. I know that's impossible. I know it's not legally, but we still expect them to do it. And the pressure on them is extraordinary.
So,
and the paradigm now is community-oriented policing. And that is the opposite. It is actually the opposite of racial profiling, the opposite of harassing people, the opposite of stop and frisk. Community-oriented policing is about making friends in the community, about an officer being stationed in one area, making friends with the people, getting the people to trust him so they'll give him hints. So if something happens, they'll say, hey, Officer so-and-so, look, you know, you didn't hear it from me, but that shooting the other day was about a drug deal gone bad. So that the people don't fear him, they trust him. What I taught people was, when you do this stuff, you're going to get the opposite of what you want. A police department that is hated, feared, and or loathed by the community will not be successful. One that is loved. The community is part of the police officer is part of the community. He's not some entity outside of the community to go in and clean out the community.
And where is this being done, really? I know.
We did a lot of agencies. A lot of agencies do it. The issue is, in particular agencies, you know, what do they? How do they deal with people who violate the rules?
That's not what I'm asking. What I'm asking, and this is the key thing here in our screwed up society today, we don't fund the police enough to have a cop on the beat, on the sidewalk, in the neighborhood. We simply don't do that. In Washington, D.C., even with crazy Washington, D.C., you've got more police than any place in the world. They're concentrated in one particular area, which, of course, is where the tourists are and everything else. They don't give a damn about the neighborhoods in the southeast. You don't have cops on the beat there. You don't have regular cops. Where the hell is this being practiced? It should be practiced, community involvement with the police, but it's not.
Right. And it gets back to this, and that is...
So you don't know of a place, Garland, where it's being practiced?
Well, it supposedly that's the big thing now. All agencies have a community-oriented police section, and they're all supposed to be practicing. How much it is practiced, and you know, in practical application, whether it's happening is a whole other thing. But every agency says they're doing it.
I'm just wondering because Bill de Blasio is going to become mayor of New York in a couple months. He was just elected to replace Michael Bloomberg. He is well known as a solid progressive, a solid liberal, someone who, he's got an African-American wife and, you know, obviously mixed race kids and all. And I just wonder whether I assume he is committed to something like community-oriented policing.
It's all about, let me say this, and this is important, and I learned this firsthand. It's all about who he puts in as the chief of police. Where the head goes, the body will follow. If he has a person who is a, you know, progressive, reasonable person who respects the citizens and their rights, then that person will, in fact, ensure that the agency is doing that. And they will make it clear that that's what's expected. And the officers will, for the most part, follow through. There will be some that won't, and those need to be dealt with.
Let me, I have a caller on the line, and I believe it's Michael from the Bronx, and I know he's got very personal views on this. Michael, you there?
Yes, I am. Thanks so much.
Hi, Michael.
So you live in New York City. How's this going on down there with the Barneys and the racial profiling and everything?
It is absolutely outrageous and out of control. And the thing is that, first off, when it comes to the Barney situation, in my view, I think this is just the NYPD's defiant reaction to the federal judge's ruling declaring their stop and frisk to be unconstitutional, and also that same federal judge calling for an independent oversight of the NYPD.
That's a really good point that we've forgotten about, and that is that we talked about it when it happened about a year ago, the federal judge saying that the New York Police Department practices racial profiling and ordering them to stop it. And you think, Michael, that the response to the Barneys people is actually the police chief, Raymond Kelly, and his, ordering his cops to be more racially profiling?
Well, I can't say more racially profiled, but trying to circumvent the decision, because remember, it was Kelly and company and Mayor Bloomberg saying there's no racial profiling going on. We're mainly in the communities of color because that's where the crimes occur, which is bogus, and I have a strong problem with that and personal problem with that, which I'll get to in a moment. But the thing is that if you're saying that that's where the crimes occur, then what the devil are you doing in the ritzy areas such as Barney's, because you were given a tip that people of color are shopping in there and they must be up to no good? I mean, why are you going to target people of color and then you're going to claim that, well, Barney's and these other big stores says that there have been a record of theft and all that stuff, but that I didn't hear anybody say theft by someone of color. It could have been someone that's Caucasian as well. And here's the personal part that I have a problem with.
Go ahead.
All right? My parents, they're both African-American. They live in a predominantly conservative area of the Bronx, known as Throgs Neck. In that section, there has been a high record of people talking on handheld cell phones while driving, texting while driving, speeding, running through stop signs, illegal drag racing, even committing vandalism, and much of the offenders are white. And the thing is that is in the area, this is an area that has very little, if not no, police patrol whatsoever. Going back to the claim of Bloomberg and Kelly saying we're mainly in the areas of high crime, which is in the communities of color. Now, to me, that is a farce. And the thing is that since they were so arrogant and going on the airways making that kind of announcement, the criminal minds know the areas to go to commit their crimes, and that is the area that has no police presence because they know they will get away with the crap that they pull. And then by the time police are arrived, whoop, too late.
That's a solid point, Michael. I want to thank you for your call. And by the way, I want to make a correction here. Bill de Blasio won the Democratic nomination. He is likely to win the mayoral election, but the mayoral election is going to occur in about 2 weeks, November 5th.
If I can give light on that to add what you were saying.
Yeah, real quick.
The polls are so far high in favor of Bill de Blasio.
Yeah, no, it looks like he's going to win by a landslide. Right, so then once he takes office, I really hope that this changes things in New York City. Thanks for your call, Michael. I always appreciate when you do call. Gentlemen, you have a comment on Michael's call?
What happens, too, is when these things happen, it increases the perception that of the understanding and the perception of what's going on. And people, now I'm not saying that Michael's wrong. He's there, not me. But I'm saying you get a couple things that happen. You get black people, if you're stopped and harassed all the time, then you interpret everything, you start interpreting everything as, you know, is this because I'm black, which is unfair to a person as a human being. You know, it violates to me a person's human rights. Everyone should be able to move about in society, and if they get stopped or whatever by the police, or if they get questioned about something, everyone should be able to feel, well, it's happening because of the substance of the issue.
Right.
But what happens is you have people, black people, or Latino, or whoever, or walking around, and everything that happens, they got to think, is this happening because I'm black? Is this happening to a white guy?
All right, gentlemen, I need to take a quick break.
It's an anxiety that's unfair, that people shouldn't have to deal with.
It's fair point.
I got to talk to you guys about the years I lived in Philadelphia.
All right, we're going to have to save that for a future show, though, because I want to take a quick break, and I want to come back and talk about what the Republicans are talking about all this week, which, of course, is the rollout of healthcare.gov. It didn't succeed as much as we wanted it to. I want to talk about the larger questions involved. Take a quick break if you want to dial in, 202-889-9797. We'll be right back with the Raucous Caucus right after this. Okay, welcome back to the Raucous Caucus. The great healthcare.gov website started on October 1st, and let's face it, it was not the rollout that any of us would have wanted to have. I myself went in on October 1st, could not get in, tried about 7 or 8 times, and was frustrated and quit. This, of course, is the website that allows people to buy plans under the Affordable Care Act, known by the Republicans and now even by a lot of Democrats as Obamacare. The good news is, and this part isn't talked about very much, on October 13th, 12 days later, I did get in, and I started to see a variety of plans, but I must say it took about 6 or 7 times to get in. I did succeed in getting in. I went again and checked yesterday. I got in immediately. I had 0 problems, and I could see a wide variety of plans, all of which provided me better services at less cost. Now, I realize the website isn't completely fixed yet. They say it's going to be fixed in another month. But I should say this to anyone listening to my voice. If you had trouble getting into healthcare.gov before, try it again. Because I had 0 problems yesterday, and that was a Saturday. But this raises a larger issue, and that is Republicans want the government to fail because their argument is the government can never succeed, and so they're working hard to make the government fail, which is a self-fulfilled prophecy, and they were crowing about the website, let's face it, this week. Who wants to start?
Let me jump in here because one of the crimes that we're seeing here with the Republicans, and it has a whole lot to do with the general media, it has also to do with our politicians, the Democrats and Obama, who aren't aggressive enough, in my opinion. Any software introduced anywhere is going to have problems initially. For the software that was used in Virginia only a little while ago, designed by Boeing, private industry, private company, to manage the finances, it took 1 year to get that software up and running right. And during that year, they couldn't even make payments. My younger brother worked for CIS, or CSI, Computer Services, big military contractor. They developed software for just logistics of moving things around the military, et cetera. Took them 3 years to get it operating correctly. My wife worked for hospice. They had a new software program. It got so bad when it was initially introduced, the tech support just issued a memo saying, do not call tech support. We can't do anything. This is what happened.
Yeah, and in fact, people don't remember, but you just go back and Google it. You can see it. Back in 2005, 2006, when President Bush rolled out his health care proposal, the Medicare Part D, you know what? The website was down. It didn't get started. It had to be done by end of the year, just like Affordable Care Act has to be done by end of the year. And by November 8th, it still wasn't working, which I need to remind people is at least 2 weeks after this week. They had tens of thousands of complaints. People at the time, it had a 21% approval rating for the Medicare Part D. Needless to say, today it works fine. It's got 90% approval rating. Liberals argue correctly, I think, that it's still a giveaway to pharmaceutical companies, but the website works. And people are getting their benefits, and most people know the Affordable Care Act actually got rid of the donut hole, so actually improved those benefits for...
The one mistake that the Obama administration made, well, they made a couple of big ones. They did not have one central organizer guy.
There were 55 different contractors in charge.
And the other thing they made is trying to introduce the whole damn program at once, and they should have done it step by step by step until they solved each step, as opposed to the whole kit and caboodle. But other than that...
Well, let me ask this question to Garland. I mean, it happened in the middle of the shutdown. Obama wanted to say, we're going forward, notwithstanding what the Republicans do, but he wasn't ready to go forward. In hindsight, should he have said, okay, we're still working on it, or would that have been even worse than the option he chose?
Should have chosen
I
one
think
step
it would have. I think,
let me hear from Garland here.
What happened... I think what happened even forced his hand more to do it, because they're trying to stop it and they're trying to defund it, and I think they really had to move forward with it in its current form. But anybody remember Windows 95? It was a disaster.
It's true.
Do you remember Windows 95?
I do. It was a disaster.
Is anybody working on Windows 8?
It was bad news. Yeah. Or Vista?
Oh, Vista's terrible.
I've had some from the very beginning. So the bottom line is this, to pretend that massive software rollout, that this is something new. However, now, let's just say for some reason I thought that Mark should be thrown in jail. And everything that Mark did, what did Mark do today? Well, he walked out and got in his car. That proves he should be thrown in jail.
Yeah.
What did Mark do next? He drove down the street and he bought a carton of milk for his cereal. That proves he should be thrown in jail. You already know that I think Mark should be thrown in jail. So anything he does, I'm going to say it proves it. From the perspective of what the Republicans are arguing, here are people that shut down the government to stop Obamacare. We already know if it would work perfectly, they'd have said that proves that it should be. Anything that happens, they were going to say that proves our point. That's number one. And one other point I'll make real quick before in closing, and that is one of the issues here is that there are 26 states who won't open their own exchanges, and that's why it's flooded. And this is what the mainstream media doesn't talk about. In the states that have their own exchanges, it works perfectly. The Republicans are sabotaging it because there's 26 states. There's probably 200 million people who have to get, who are getting on this website. If it had gone forth as planned, and if the Supreme Court hadn't changed things, if every state had their own exchange, all of these people wouldn't be on healthcare.gov. They'd be doing their own state exchange, and none of them would be flooded. So they went against what they say they believe in, that the state should do things itself, states' rights, number one. And number two, they caused the website to be flooded by not creating their own exchange, and now they say that's proof that Obamacare should be tossed.
And to add to that one thing, I think we've reached a point where journalism today, including perhaps even some of us, just it's anti-government, period. Journalism is anti-government.
It's garbage.
They can find anything wrong with it. That's the news, period.
Yeah, but my question is this, though. Here's the thing. It's very easy to want something to fail and to make it fail. It's much, much harder than to make something succeed. I mean, if you are building a model airplane and you're using your glue and your tools and everything, and my goal is to stop you from building that, okay, I'm going to have a lot easier task. I went in with a hammer and I slammed your plane, right? I mean, it's you're trying to do an intricate task of making a whole bunch of parts fit together, and I'm just trying to slam it with a hammer. Likely, I'm going to succeed more than you, even if you're more determined than I am, because my job is a lot easier. It's very easy to make things fail. It's very hard to make things succeed.
More that are changing our society, and I don't know how to fix these changes, but they are things that are eroding our society. If you look back at the space program that began in the United States back in the late 60s and the 70s and everything else, it was simply disaster after disaster after disaster. I mean, it was an embarrassing disaster after disaster. What was the attitude? Work harder. That was the attitude. Keep going, work harder, try it again. That attitude in our society in general is simply gone, whether it's football or whether it's software. If you don't win today, you're out, forget about you, we don't want you. And it's an insane culture that is driving this.
By the way, one quick correction, Garland. It's 36 states that don't have the exchanges. Only 14 have them.
Yeah, so it's a sabotage. Good point, Terry. Normally what said is, we're the Americans, we don't give up. We keep going. We're having problems, so can we throw in the towel and give up? And people, the media discusses the Republicans' arguments as though it weren't based on a fundamental belief that Obamacare should be thrown out. When the Republicans complain, the media doesn't even mention, well, these are people that want it out anyway. They discuss it as though it's some kind of an unbiased position that the Republican Party is taking based on, you know, wanting everything to be wonderful. That's number one. Number two, the last time I checked, we were doing this so that people could get health care coverage and so that we could save the lives of Americans and give them an opportunity to have health care coverage. I didn't think this was all about a website. Well, the website won't work, so hey, let them all die.
Well, yeah, that's the other thing, is that the Republican alternative is that millions of tens of millions of Americans go without health care. I mean, that is the alternative. Either we fix the website or tens of millions of Americans are sick and don't get care. Or maybe die. You know, it's like, I don't know. Fixing the website's difficult, or tens of millions of Americans will suffer. You know, tough choice, I guess.
We don't live in an era where people want to look at the complexity of life, period.
Go ahead, go.
Our entire culture teaches them that.
And if my family didn't have coverage right now, you know, let's just say I'm a man with a wife and three kids, you know, whatever, and I'm working my own business, whatever, my family doesn't have coverage. And now I see an opportunity that I can get health care coverage for my family at an affordable rate. You know what? If I got to go on the website 10 times, I got to wait till 3 o'clock in the morning where people aren't, I'm going to do it.
That's right.
Now my son or daughter who had juvenile diabetes or whatever, and I couldn't get coverage because either a pre-existing condition or it was going to cost me a fortune, I'm going to do whatever I have to do to get on that website, and then I'm going to jump up and down January 1st and say, hooray, let's all go to the doctors now. We're finally covered.
The other thing is we have time. We have time. I mean, we have until December 15th to get coverage for January 1st. And if you miss that, you have till January 15th to get coverage for February 1st. You have all the way till March 31st to sign up for any plan. So the idea that, oh my God, it did not work on day one, and it didn't. I mean, I'm going to be honest. It didn't work on day one, but as if that somehow precludes it ever working. What universe are they living in? I mean, people have such short memories.
They really do. And it's sad.
One thing that I found was interesting is I went on, Fox News, to talk about this yesterday, about the rollout of Obamacare, and said, you know, chill. This is important, and this is a minor glitch, and we'll get over it. And I was reading some of the comments on the website afterwards, and someone tweeted at me, but the waiting lines will be longer. And I went back to this woman, I think it was a woman, and said, now wait a minute, what you're saying is if poor people and middle-class people who couldn't get health care before now have the option of treating their illness, you're concerned you're going to have to wait a little longer? You'd rather they just die because you might have to wait 10 more minutes for your appointment? I mean,
not only that, you know what else is going to happen? Well, I tell you what's going to happen. There'll be more clinics opening up.
Well, exactly. More people.
Doctor's office open up. There'll be
more demand, right?
30 million people with it now. And so now, if you're a business person and you know, MedStar or whatever, where I go, I guarantee you they're going to open up 8 or 10 more clinics.
Exactly. But for me, was I was even, while I think you're right, Garland, I wasn't even going there to that sort of practical response. My thought was really the moral question. This woman is saying that, no, let those people die. They can't afford health care. And, you know, I need to see the doctor about my ingrown toenail now. The kid with cancer can wait, you know, because they don't have health care. They're not as important as I am.
When you don't even know that's going to happen, when the fact of the matter is, it may very well be that they open up so many more clinics,
true,
so many more places that you can go, that it gets, but it's motivated reasoning. She's not saying that because it's true. She's saying that because she doesn't believe in Obamacare. She hates it, probably doesn't even know anything about it, but she wants to stop it. So she'll say anything that she needs to say, because it's nothing more than motivated reasoning.
It was
Garland's earlier point isn't a crucial point, and we were talking about it at the very beginning of the show. Every time the government, some way or another, responsibly subsidize, or irresponsibly, but responsibly subsidize something, which is what we're doing a little bit more of in healthcare, it creates progress, it creates jobs, it creates advancement, it creates business. It always has, whether it's railroads or healthcare, and the same thing will happen with this, just as you were saying.
Yeah, I just think it's a matter of time, and I don't think anyone remembers the difficulties of the Social Security rollout or the difficulties in the Medicare rollout, or, as I pointed out just 10 years ago, the difficulties in George Bush's Medicare Part D rollout. But I did happen to look at what Speaker Boehner said at the time. He was newly Speaker of the House. He'd just been chosen. And he said, in effect, you know, this is a minor problem, and we're going to get past this, and I'm sure everyone will be just fine. And I'm thinking, what's the difference between this medical website going down and the other medical website going down?
And the internet.
And also remember how vehemently the conservatives in this country opposed Medicare and opposed Social Security and anything else that helps the poor or the middle class.
And one more thing, and this is obscure but important. We used to have an office in the United States government from 1972 till 1996. It was called the Office of Technology Assessment. It was an office that very carefully, it had been around since 72 under Richard Nixon, an office that basically analyzed the needs, the computer needs of the United States government to have the latest, best technology of any kind for the country. Newt Gingrich in 1996 considered this his prime example of wasteful government and shut it down. And I just wonder if the Office of Technology Assessment had still been around, whether or not both these websites under Bush and Obama might have come out with better rollouts. I guess we'll never know. Gentlemen, that's all the time we've got for today. Terry, if they want to find you, where do they go?
Any healthcare organization, any hospital, you know, any website. I'm just there trying to get online like everybody else, but I'm patient. Or they can just simply go to drdrofdemocracy@aol.com.
Fair enough. And Garland?
At Garland Nixon on Twitter, or Garland Nixon on Facebook, or garlandin@gmail.com email.
And I am at Mark Levine Talk on Facebook, facebook.com/Mark Levine Talk. My website's marklevinetalk.com. And on that website, you can hear every edition of the Raucous Caucus going back years. You can also hear a show that Garland and I do called News Views. You can see my appearances on Fox News. You can have other shows of the Inside Scoop. There's a lot there. I hope you'll check it out. That's all the time we've got, gentlemen. Tune in next week at noon for another edition of the Raucous Caucus. Thanks, guys.
Thanks, Mark.